very welcome to this evening's event. I'm Erik Bergloff. I'm the director of the Institute of Global Affairs. The topic of today's discussion is the Maidan Revolution, Lessons Learned and Unlearned. So it's part of the LSE Literary Festival, so it is an event that is going along a theme, and the theme is revolutions. And I had the pleasure and very life-changing experience of working in Ukraine during this period right after the Maidan Revolution. And I've been following Ukraine for many years, but I had sort of kind of given up on Ukraine, that things will never really change. And, you know, a lot of people probably had drawn similar conclusions after what happened with the Orange Revolution. So the Maidan Revolution was, of course, a very recent revolution, and it's maybe too early to evaluate what really happened and whether it will have lasting impact. I'm sure we'll come back to that. So why do we call it a revolution? Well, I checked what the definition of a revolution is, and it's sort of a forcible overthrow of a government in favor of a new system. I think on both those parts, I think on the first part, I guess there was some force involved, and even though the force was probably mostly coming from the other side, and in the end, it was more the mass of support for the demonstrators that made this, at least in the short run, a success in favor of a new system. So I think probably we can agree that there was this desire to have a new system, but did they really get a new system? I guess that's the question. And again, it may be too early to assess that, but I'm sure there, among the panelists, there are different views of how far Ukraine has gotten, and I'm sure there is in the audience different views of that too, and we'll definitely have a chance to come back to this when we have our question and answers. So it's clear that there were people who wanted more change than they actually got, and maybe there were people who felt that they got too much change. And of course, what was very important in this change process was the role of civil society, and we have representatives here on the panel for civil society. So let me just say the rules of the game. We're going to have a short introductions from the panelists. Then there will be opportunity for the people in the audience to ask questions. We know that this is a heated issue and an issue that there are many different views, and we want this to come out in the discussion. And again, that's what LSE is all about. But please respect this order of proceedings, that we will start with the panel and then we'll open it up for questions. Unfortunately, one of our panelists seems to have been lost in the process. We hope that it's... She's not here until in 45 minutes, which is not as good. But we will do it better. She will ask her to comment on everything that has been said. So can I... I'll first introduce the panel, and then I'll ask Mustafa. So Mustafa Nayem is someone who was a journalist, but very much a participant, a civil society participant, and of course now has become a member of parliament. I think one of the most visible, most articulate commentators also, and of course participant in the Maidan Revolution. So we're very happy to have Mustafa here. Next to me I have Olena Bilan, who is the chief economist of Dragon Capital, a major investment bank, a financial institution in Ukraine, but she has also been very much involved in thinking through the economic aspects of reform, and also been part of creating a whole new civil society institution, the Vox Ukraine, which is, I think, in many ways changed the way the policy discussion takes place in Ukraine, much more evidence-based, much more modern crowdsourcing, commenting on various policy documents. It's become a very important institution. It's just a few years old, but maybe you can say something about it. Finally, and not the least at all, is Vladislav Raskovan, who was the deputy governor of the central bank in Ukraine. You know, so prior to the Maidan Revolution, probably the central bank was the most or the second most corrupted institution, the most important source of corruption in Ukraine, and Vlad was very much part of transforming that institution, but he also had a much broader role in pushing economic and to some extent also political reform in the country. It was just announced today that Vlad is the new Ukrainian representative at the IMF in Washington, so congratulations. But I think that is a tribute to the role that he played in Maidan, and he also actually has a personal story to tell about the role he played doing that. But Mustafa, can I start with you? And please feel free to just introduce us and to what happened and what you learned from it.
First of all, thank you for inviting, for opportunity to talk to you, and I'm very excited that so many people are interested in Ukrainian situation now. You know, many people really called the situation we had in 2013, 2014 as a revolution. And you're right that the revolution has some definition, and that you cannot call what we had on that days the revolution as it is. I would like that it was time of change, of very fast change of Ukraine society and mentality of young people. And I think that we will talk about consequence of revolution and the results of revolution a little bit later. For me, these 4 months, it was time when we changed the mentality of young generation of Ukraine. Now, the two closest countries which are to Ukraine, like Belarus and Russia, we always compare these three countries, you know, because they're Slavic and they are close. And one of the biggest difference between those three countries is just that young generation in Russia, in Belarus, they already, unfortunately, infected by fear of government, which was the consequence of Soviet time. And actually, in 2013, we proceeded this fight against this fear. We proceeded the fight we started in 2005, because starting 1989, the generation we now have in Ukraine, we were grew up by communists, by Komsomolce, and we have the same mentality. But the example of successful in all our countries, in Russia, in Belarus, in all post-Soviet countries, were those brutal guys who actually earned money, who violated constitution, violated rules, and violated everything just to get power. And for us, these 4 months changed one thing. Now Ukraine, young generation, and Ukraine society as a people don't afraid of government. Government it really serves people in many ways. And also we have the sins of last generation, we have the sins of bureaucracy, the sins of oligarchy, the sins of those old style elite who actually running country for themselves. We have it. We didn't, you know, fight it. We are not those people who actually has a victory on it. But now we see that government afraid of people, and government is accountable, and we can ask them. We can force government to do something. And if you ask me what is the biggest result of revolution for us, it's unfortunately it's not those leadership we have now. And it's not because of they bad or people of Ukraine was not strong to elect someone else. The biggest crime was done against Ukraine these days. I mean, after the revolution immediately, it was war. And actually, war shifted agenda of Maidan. And it's the biggest crime of Mr. Putin was that he tried to erase this agenda, to try to erase the demand of Maidan. Those people who actually wanted to have uncorrupt government, uncorrupt elite, parliament, and president. And of course, we elected those people who, at that moment, was able to run military forces, to run and to save country. And I think that real result of revolution. It's postponed, actually, because those people who were standing on Maidan, not all of them are inside the government. Not all of them are inside bodies. Not all of them has a chance to influence systems. So I think that the consequence we'll see maybe next election, maybe in 5-7 years. But what we did is that now, if you ask me who is running country, who is running Ukraine, formally, this is really president, prime minister, ministers, parliament, and government. But in real life, this is civil society. Actually, I think it is golden age of civil society in Ukraine. Who is putting agenda of anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine? Civil society. Who is doing everything which is about transparent government? This is civil society. And actually, civil society with our international partners, with those people who really want to change something inside government, these are results of revolution. This is the lesson we have. First, is that we should be united as a civilians. I mean, as those people who really can insist and ask. And actually, that's the difference between revolution 2013 or revolution of dignity or this protest and what we did in 2005. Who remember, we had Orange Revolution, and after Orange Revolution, it was like, you know, big holiday because people just, Viktor Yushchenko won the election and people went home. And that's it. That's actually collapsed everything, all changes, all hopes we had that day. Now people are very conscious, and you see that those who actually standed on Orange Maidan, I was 25, now we are 35, 40 people, 40 years old, and those people are really insist, and they really stand for their values, and they're really asking. The other result of revolution, the lesson, is that, you know, unfortunately, to be honest, be clear, being clear, being honest, and being uncorrupt, it's not enough. We are very passionate, but now it is obvious that we should be experienced. One day, and we see it, these days will come very soon, country will change their leads. And the new generation will be those people who should take responsibility. And my nightmare is that day we will not be prepared. I think the biggest efforts now doing by new generation, they're learning how to govern, learning to take responsibility, learning to run country and to lead country. And I'm happy that there are many people inside government who are really actually damaged because they lost their reputation, they lost the support of people, but they still insist and they're convinced in what they're doing. Like, you know, Maxim Nefedov, who is doing well things and very bright things in government. We have tremendous amount of parliamentarians. We have a lot of people. Just believe me, there are many people in local level, people who entered local councils, local administrations, and also the government, who really are now learning. And I think this is the basement of new Ukraine. And if they will really come to power, and I think they will come maybe in 5-7 years, I think you will see new Ukraine. And now we are preparing for that moment. But this is the most challenged time, because now we should do things to building up institutions irreversible. And I think this is the biggest responsibility of our age, our generation, to make change irreversible. I think we will do that. Thank you.
I think what you're reminding us, and this is when I first came to Ukraine after the Maidan, I think it was in April or maybe May, beginning of May, you know, the country didn't have a legitimate president. It didn't have a legitimate parliament. I think much of the government administration was, really without any legitimacy. And now you're part of a new generation. I think we were a group of 50 young parliamentarians that came in at the same time, fresh blood, you know, previous political experience really, and has, you know, I think quite fundamentally changed the way politics works in Ukraine. So thank you very much, Mustafa. Vlad, can I ask you to say a little bit about your experience, maybe also starting where, or you can maybe later tell us what happened during Maidan to you.
Thanks. It's a privilege to be here, and it was also a privilege to be today, speaking in the morning to the class of and we were discussing already some topics. But I will say about the personal story. But I would probably start with three, hypotheses or which we may discuss further, because I'm sure you have questions more than what we want to tell you. And the first hypothesis for me is that in 2014 there was not the start of the revolution. Even if we speak about the revolution of dignity, I think we need to take the longer perspective. Because I think the Fourth Republic, as we name in Ukraine, started not in 2014, but in 2004, during the Orange Revolution. At that time, the civil society went to the streets, and it was a pure, direct democracy. People went in order to have the equal access to justice. Unfortunately, it did not come out with some substantial or sustainable results. But anyway, it was a start of the revolution. And I was at that time 26. I just came back from studying from PhD study abroad. I was a teacher and assistant professor in the university, and my students were living on Maidan, and I was bringing the food, the hot food there to them. And after the third round of the elections, of the present elections, when I was also the assistant of the observers at that time, we received a letter, especially those who were graduating from abroad universities, Western universities, we received a letter saying that factually you will be most probably demanded for new government. I know some people didn't want to go, and some people wanted to go, but nobody received finally the invitation letter. This was, I think, one of the lessons which was not learned after 2014, and where we came to 2014, and it is exactly what Mustafa just said. In 2004, the civil society didn't want to become the power in the country and didn't want to fight seriously with the old regime of the Soviet Union and even post-Soviet Union. And unfortunately, I mean, going just to the streets, going to Maidan was not enough to change the country. Therefore, we lived through to 2014, where we came again to the same moment when people went out to the streets fighting for the equal access to the justice. And it was not about European Union. It was really because people wanted justice in the country. But again, going to the streets for hundreds of thousands of people was not enough, because the civil society was not institutionalized. It was very well self-organized. It was very well determined, but not institutionalized. And therefore, after the Maidan, people went home and sitting and looking how the new government would change the country. There were only few people also. I was one of them who joined the government. Actually, I was showing today during the lecture the picture when I entered the government and the central bank, how the main square was looking like. It was completely destroyed. Ukraine was destroyed, and Mustafa properly said we were living through the war, we were living through the internal war, not only with Russia, but we were living the war with internal corruption and with our past, with Soviet past. So few people went to the government, I think only now, and this is what Mustafa said, I fully agree, only now the civil activist and civil society understands that really there is a need of the institutionalization, bringing people together. And I'm sure that revolution didn't start in 2014 and it didn't finish in 2016. Mm-hmm. So this is my first hypothesis. Mm-hmm. The second hypothesis is about the following. We were always saying about weak institutions. And more I say about that in Ukraine, and more I say about that, I think we have vice versa. We have strong institutions in Ukraine, but we have strong institutions with Soviet roots. Because the central bank, the building which I was going, is a building of the old Soviet Republic, of the state bank of Soviet Union. Most ministries are the old, ministries of the Ukrainian Republic. Even the president administration office is an old building of the Communist Party, where the head of the Communist Party was sitting, and you go to the same corridors, and you can understand how you can think about the 21st century, how you can think about the innovations when you go through the red carpet corridors. And truly saying, the president administration was a place which was changed inside in the last few years to better. It became a more open space. And therefore, it's, it was showing the potential change. But these institutions, I mean, the old Soviet institutions, they were very strong. Moreover, in the last 25 years, they became even more prepared for, to resist to changes. There were new people who came there, and they were supporting not to how not to change, how not to transform those institutions. What does it mean? Should we destroy those institutions? Should we put our energy to destroy those institutions like it was done with the Berlin Wall? I don't think so. And this is what we were doing in the central bank. We were not destroying the institution. We were trying to build a new institution. And new institution could be absolutely with new faces, new functions, new processes. It should be looking, you know, the probably open space platforms, less big rooms, you know, with a lot of the green and gold colors in the rooms. We should bring, you know, more innovations, more technologies in the institution. And you cannot do that, believe me, with all the institutions. Those who are involved in the transformation of the different institutions, both in corporate and public, understand how to rebuild, and it is very difficult. And therefore, I would not recommend, and I was not recommending to do it in the central bank, and I'm not recommending this to do in other government institutions. We really need to build, we need to take time to build institutions. It takes time. It cannot be done in one day, it cannot be done in one month, it cannot be done even in one year. But we already spent 3 years. If we would have started to rebuild the institutions 3 years ago, we would be much more in advance. Unfortunately, among the Ukrainian institutions, I think the central bank was among one, two, three institutions which really took it seriously, you know, to rebuild the institution, to build a new institution. And we were on a good path to succeed. And we can discuss later, I mean, how exactly. So the third hypothesis is that this is what Mustafa said, is that temporary civil society did not achieve so far what it was expecting to achieve, you know? Because for sure, if you ask 100 most active people who were in Maidan, are you satisfied where we are today? I think the answer would be no, but we're in the right direction. And when you ask ourselves, when we ask ourselves, including together with Mustafa and Lena, you know, why did it happen? I think there is an answer, and we recently were in one session where we discussed that. There is the three answers. One is there was not enough people who entered the government, new people, new faces, first. Second, these people were not a team, because the people came in different time, drop by drop, in different agencies. And give you an example, in the central bank, in the first 5 months, we brought 10 people new. You know how many we had people? It was 12,000. So 12,000 versus 11.99 people were old, who were usually who used to work there for more than 15 years, and who were ready to protect what was there in the past, versus 10 people new. Finally, you know what we did? We fired 7,800 people from there, and we hired 650 new. Is it enough? No. But we had 12,000 people. Now we have 5,000 people in the National Bank, and we will have 1,800 people in the National Bank in a few years. And I think in these 1,800, probably 1,000 will be already new, or 1,200 will be new people, and it will be already a new institution. So, not enough people, they were not a team, and third, as Mustafa said, people were not prepared. Not prepared, not trained, and not prepared to fight or to live through the toxic public service environment. It is very difficult, you know. I think we can talk today, you know, if you, Lena, maybe, or we can talk later, that, you know, the public sector is not a magnet for talents today. Is not the place where people would dream to. I mean, people with values, people with Western education, people with, you know, the view, vision, young people, this is not the place where they would like to spend their time. They want to work in the corporations, they want to go abroad, they want to work in a multinational corporation, which is normal, you know. But unfortunately, sometimes you need to sacrifice some part of your career to take the duty call. This is exactly how I took my duty call in 2015. I used to work in the financial institution, in the big financial institution, and I was supposed to work in Vienna in 2014, and I had already the contract. And I had to take my duty call, because in 2004, I was in Maidan helping my students. In 2015, I was taking by my car people from the trade union building, and just exactly 3 years ago, wounded people to the church in the night. You know, when I was invited to come to the government, I could not resist for that. I could not refuse. I had to help my country. And this is, I think, what we need to do further. We need to have to bring more people to the government. We need to make them as a team. And we need to train them. And I hope we will discuss later, you know, with, you know, how LSE could help as well. But we are working in Ukraine how to prepare a set of courses to, for those new government officials. And with new online courses, you can spend, you can teach simultaneously thousands of people with a theory of the state, with a theory of democracy, with practice of transformation, with practice of the reforms in other countries, and some even social, you know, soft skills which people need to work in government. And I'm sure we will succeed. Thanks.
So when I first met Olena, it was in an event that we were part of organizing where we brought together Ukrainians from all parts of society, but also from all over the world. We stayed together for, I guess, two and a half days. And at the end of these two and a half days, a lot of discussions of different policy issues and so on, and parallel discussions, roundtable discussions. And Elena came with a couple of friends and said, you know, we really want to be engaged. And it was a group of people who were either trained in Ukraine and working in the private sector, but they were also trained abroad and they wanted to be part of this. And it was the embryo of something that became Vox Ukraine that I mentioned to you before. Olena, give us your story.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. You actually described part of my so it took part of my speech. But anyway, I'm really happy to be here, and it's a privilege for me to speak about Vox Ukraine, which is really it's a big part of my life. But let me start from a little bit earlier, from this dark days of Yanukovych era, or how we call it. So that actually this was a quite depressing period for Ukraine, and I have to be honest. So, despite having a very respected and well-paid job as in the investment bank, in the leading investment bank in Ukraine, I was thinking about leaving the country because at that time the prospects of the country were really dark. But the revolution of dignity changed myself. And changed my perception. And it happened actually very unexpectedly for me. I was just driving my car to the office, and one important thought came to my mind that this is my country, and I want to stay here, and I want to change it for better. I didn't know how to change it, but this was a kind of an internal revolution for myself. And I think it definitely was not unique, and it was shared by many, and by such bright individuals as Mustafa and Vlad. So when some of us went to the government and to the parliament, and others as myself decided to go to the civil society to cultivate it and to help it growing. So basically, as Eric said, it all started in mid-2014 and with this big strategic conference that he organized, and I'm very thankful because at this conference I've met like-minded people, my former university classmates, who were also wanted to make some change. So, and we all together we shared a common education. We graduated from the what is now called the Kyiv School of Economics. It's a Western-style MA program in economics. And actually, we were really disappointed by the quality of the public discussion on economic issues in Ukraine. So when we wanted to change this, and we started from what we know how to do. We know how to write good economic papers and texts, and we decided to establish a blog. But it was a little bit different from the common blog because we formed an editorial board, and we solicited articles and posts which are evidence-based, not just based on slogans or some strong wording like this. So actually now it remains our core activity of Vox Ukraine is a blog. It is run in three languages, in Ukrainian, Russian, and English. So we translate almost all articles, and that's all Ukraine and Russian Ukrainian Russian articles are reprinted in local media, in top online outlets. So we cover a big audience domestically, and we also provide an insight to international audience about what's going on in Ukraine. So it's a high-quality economic analysis on topical issues. But it was just a start, actually. Then we developed a lot of watchdog activities. And actually, the whole period with Vox Ukraine as an editorial board member and kind of a founder of the organization, I call it intellectual volunteering, because a lot of these projects are somehow either unique or for Ukraine, or we pioneered them, so we brought them to the country. So one of them is the Index for Monitoring Reforms, which is, I think, a unique tool to track to track the dynamics and to get a quantitative assessment of economic reforms in the country. Last year, we launched, actually, we were not launched, but we were first to bring to Ukraine fact-checking project. So it's called Vox Check, and it's, I think, is very important tool to keep politicians accountable, because before that, they felt absolutely free to manipulate data, to use even wrong numbers in their public speeches, even from parliamentary tribune. They continue to do it now from time to time, but now they know that they could be checked, and actually this will be printed, so this fact-checking will be printed in top Ukrainian media. So this year we decided to go to the regions because, you know, a lot of, you know, this, even, you know, the best economic thinking, which is still not as good as I would like to see it, but it's concentrated in Kyiv. And when you go to the regions, you know, the quality of the media here and the expertise is very, very low. So we decided to establish a new kind of to launch a new project that would provide a high quality expertise to the regions. So that's a brief description of what we do. This 3 years were a really intensive period of my life, but also very enlightening and very thoughtful, and it made me think about many things. And one thing that I really learned from this experience is that each effort counts. And this is that Vox Ukraine demonstrates perfectly. So many of our board members, they actually, some of them live abroad, so we have huge time difference. So, they're Ukrainians, but definitely they have their families there, but they continue to contribute. So many sacrifice their spare time, many have their full-time job, their families, and they have to do something. They still continue doing something. It's still pure volunteering. So that our efforts of a dozen of people to manage to bring this, what I think is a quite big achievement in terms of developing the civil society in Ukraine. But unfortunately, this was not enough to make Ukraine a successful reformer. Neither our efforts nor efforts of this bright people, these newcomers to politics, to government, to the central bank, they were not enough. And my explanation for this is in the political sphere, in the sphere of political economy. I think that both revolutions, the one that was in 2004 and the recent one in 2014, the people who participated in the revolution, they didn't demand a change of the political system. And all the key problems that Ukraine have is a kind of their root in the political system. This is a system that reminds you of an investment club that serves an interest of the few. So especially when some seats in the parliament, there are reports that they could be purchased, and it's very difficult to get to the parliament without having a sponsor. And once you get here, you have to repay to the sponsor. So that's actually doesn't mean that the revolution of dignity failed or the Orange Revolution failed. I think that the biggest achievement of the latest of the revolution are people. So this small group of people like Vlad, like Mustafa, who now know the system. They learn the political process. They now understand the process of managing reforms. So they know what to do and how to do. And definitely now, reactionary forces, they try to put pressure on those people. They try to force them out of the system. They try to intimidate them. But these people stay and they get together. They discuss the country's future. And I think that when the next critical juncture arises, these people will be able to really change the country dramatically and transform it into a successful country. And this really keeps me hopeful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elena. So now the time is for you to ask questions. Please be brief, introduce yourself, and we start. So let's take a batch of three. One, two, three over there. And then, yep.
Hi, my name is Simon. I'm a master student here. I wanted to ask, how important is the Western commitment to integrate Ukraine into EU and NATO for reforms to be successful, and whether this is a firm commitment is a main driver to changes?
Yeah.
My name is Mohammed Alta.
Just hide the hard biscuit in your pocket. Fine, don't worry.
My question is to Vlad and Papa. How did you deal with the counter-revolution, particularly the new state, when you were mentioning the firing of 7,000 people from the central bank? How did you manage to do this without the backfire, without them basically paralyzing the central bank?
Yeah, and speaking with some experience from the Egyptian Tahrir Square experience. So I had one question over there.
Myself.
You are the next.
Thank you. I'm Najam from the East West Institute. Panel mostly spoke about the path taken and the lessons learned from there. May I invite some input on path not taken and lessons not learned? So, for example, would anybody from the panel say that taking a cautious approach in February of 2015 and waiting 10 months so that Viktor Yanukovych completes his presidential term, bows out, and new elections are held, could it have left Ukraine safer?
Yeah.
Or paying the price in Crimea, Donetsk, and Luhansk was worth the adventure? Thank you.
Okay, I think these are three excellent questions. So we'll have this round first, and then we'll come back and you get another round. Mustafa, you seem ready to go.
Okay. I'll try to start from the commitment of Europe involving Ukraine, European Union, and NATO. You know, one of the mistakes of our elites and leadership during our independence time was that they all time they told us that, you know, there's something out of Ukraine which should dictate what should happen inside Ukraine. It doesn't matter, Russia or someone else. And actually that makes problem, because elites grew up in situation when they explaining the decision not because people of Ukraine want, but someone else, Mr. Putin or someone else, or someone from United States or someone from European Union. Which is very important, by the way, because they are our partners. It is obvious that we are very close with our values, with our inspirations, with our instincts, and etc. But the biggest problem for us, because it makes us weaker when you're thinking about something outside. I think now, for us, the most important thing is what is going on in our country and what people of Ukraine want. I will give you one example. You know that now this discussion with Mr. Putin from United States, from European Union, and with tough speeches and trying to cut sanctions or not to cut sanctions, all these discussions. I'm convinced that all these discussions could happen only by one reason, not because they are strong unfortunately, we see that many politicians outside of Ukraine and outside of Europe and inside Europe also, they are about business and about some, you know, very pragmatic things than about values. This is reality. Yeah? We are frank on that. The only reason they can allow themselves to be so hard with Mr. Putin is that our soldiers are staying on the front line. Just imagine that Ukraine gave up at that moment. Just imagine this: those forces, separatists or terrorists, whatever they call, they will come to Kyiv or to the border of Poland. So I always say that looking for European Union, we actually found Ukraine, the real Ukraine. The real Ukraine, and we feel now what is going on about. We understand that there are different sides of United States, we saw. The different sides of Great Britain, different sides of Netherlands, different sides of European Union. And actually, the Ukraine is only one country in Europe in which people died with the flag of European Union. And my conviction is that actually the values we stand for 3 years ago is the same. But unfortunately, partners are changing. And it's okay, because it's our country, it's our interest. So we are really grateful for this commitment to Ukraine. But again and again, it's about our country.
Gustav, you mentioned Ukraine.
Okay, please, can we keep the order? Keep, please.
Are you going to mention that they're sharing
please.
Sir,
can we keep the order? We will. We will. You will have a chair.
Please. Sir, have you finished? May I answer? May I answer? Thank you. So, let's proceed. And about counter-revolution, and you told about this, you know, our anti-revolution in our government bodies. I think, you know, the biggest problem for us now is just to find who is against us, because this is system. It's not about some, you know, we doesn't have this devil who is constructing everything against us. But the system all these years was building up to fight against those people who really want to change something. So, and this is the biggest problem for us and challenge, not to fight against persons, but to fight against system. And how we survive, actually, it is very tough. I cannot say we survived already. Just let's wait. I don't think that it will be easy way. And my colleague Vlad is right that we are not too much of us there. And actually, it's depressing. I can say that many people who are inside system, they are depressed by this resistance. And that's the big problem. And about the last question was about...
The last one, you know, why didn't you wait for Yanukovych's term?
There is not black and white situation. And I want to be very careful and sensitive with it. First, it is obvious that all our people, and me personally, you regret that we lost our soldiers and protesters on Maidan. This is... They've sacrificed themselves for our change.
Yeah. So.
Okay, I will proceed with a very short answer because my time was stolen a little bit. Okay, I just again a very sensitive issue you raised about this protest and worth it or not. So we really regret that we had this many people injured and killed, and all these victims. But my deep conviction is that what I told the first when I started. Mr. Yanukovych didn't have a chance to be president again. It is obvious. But from the other side, we saw the methods, how he took the power, and this pyramid and system he built up. And the last months of his presidency, he got a very big loan from Russia, you know, this $3 billion. And actually, for me and for people of Ukraine, was obvious that this guy will never give up. And he was hostage of this system. And I think the only consequence and the only one way for him to stay a president was to build up system like we had in Belarus, in Russia. And I'm sure, I'm convinced that look what he did in the last days of his presidency. Actually, it was preparing to kill people, to jail people, to repress people. And I'm sure that he didn't have other choice just to go that way. If he would not protest at that moment, we convert country in something we will never recognize again. I believe that those people who were standing on Maidan, just remember why all those people was not killed, not all of them. Just because of international support, just because of protest, but very harmfully before that, many people were jailed. They adopted legislation which is allowed them to do whatever they want. And from the other side, you're right that maybe we should have to that way to wait that days. But as a generation, I believe that it was a moment of trust, and it was a moment when we said no. And he has options to listen to us, to stop, to deal, or to kill. And why we think that if he did it that time, he would not do it again in the future? Because in that moment, you know, not all people of Ukraine understood what is going on. About freedom of speech, you know, I was prohibited and banned in Ukrainian TV. There were topics which was banned on Ukrainian TV at all. Any investigations about his residence, about his family, about corruption in the country. So it was very big gap between what was in real life, the system they built up, in Minister of Interior, Secret Services, and Army, and from the other side, the real situation, how people live. And this gap, we would not able to, you know, to cover it. So from my perspective, it was preparation to make Ukraine the small copy of Belarus. And I worked in Belarus, I know what is that. Those people who worked or saw what is going on there, you understand me. Our opposition is jailed, activists are jailed, many people died or disappeared. Maybe it was some choice for us, but our generation told no. So it is obvious for me that we didn't have any other option. Or we would have the same thing in 2-3 years, or maybe in 7-5 months, when he didn't sign this agreement with the European Union. Thank you.
Vlad, can you say something also about this question about the deep state?
I was thinking how to find the metaphor to answer the questions, and you know, I thought about that. I have two kids, you know, and one of them is, my daughter is 12 and my son is 6. I truly believe in them. I believe in their future. I believe they will make it, you know, the good, you know, the career, life, etc., families. But I will not help them if they don't believe in themselves. If I will not teach them or will not educate them to believe in themselves. So the question is, IMF program or fund which is national, which Ukraine has. Actually, we name it IMF program, but it is not IMF program. It's Ukrainian program, which is just supported by IMF. For example, the part about the banking sector was written by the central bank, so it was not written by IMF. We really put there something which we truly believed in, and whatever we believed was already previously put in the strategy which we developed in the central bank, which is a longer term strategy. It's not shorter term than the program is. So. And this is what Aliena said, I think is one of the maybe main thoughts of tonight, is that she started to believe in herself, not deciding to leave the country. And more people will start believing in themselves, more people will start, will think that they can make change, and this is about the civil society role in the country redevelopment, more successful Ukraine will be. This is only one, and this is exactly what Mustafa said in the beginning. More people start being drop by drop, start thinking that they can make changes, and we will come there. And for sure, when you have the external anchor like European Union, it's easier, you know, or NATO. And as I was told recently, you know, I'm a specialist in transformation of the large organizations. So when you know where you are today, you know where you want to come, where you have a vision, you know how many resources you have, you know how much your timeline, risks, team, and you go and you make things happen. But it's nice when you can have, it's easy, you know, when you have, it's much more difficult when you don't have that anchor in the end and you don't know where to bring the content. And this is maybe a part of the answer which was said about the lessons learned or not learned. I think one of the lessons which was not learned was linked to the fact that, sometimes reforms are painful. Sometimes you don't know where you will come because it's unpredictable results. The resistance could be very difficult, very hard, and you will not make it. So you could fail in results. So you fail. I mean, you're a politician or you're a government, so you quit. This is easy. But many people don't want to quit or don't want to fail. Therefore, they don't want to make mistakes and they don't do anything. You know, because you don't make mistake when you don't do anything. You know, this nice statement about that, and so we practiced in the central bank. So we had a vision, we had a strategy which was we translated this vision. We had a belief that we can make it. We had a great team which we composed to make things happen, and we had a common values and common vision and common values which put us together. And I will answer you if you come to me in the corridor. I will tell you what we did, how to lay off people. I was telling about this already during the lecture today. Everything was properly done like you would do it in the corporations and the big organizations. Unfortunately, not many institutions follow that because they were afraid to make the mistakes. You know, and that's why they didn't do. They did just normal, like a 10% decrease of number of people, which is never appearing 10%. It's usually vacancies you close, and then 3 months later, you just open those vacancies again because you think that you need much more to be done. We were serious because when you go from 11,800 for 12,000 people to 1.8, you cannot just say it's 10%. You completely rebuild the institution.
Yeah, just a short comment on this, okay? And basically on the last question about the lessons not learned, and let me elaborate a little bit again about the political system, because I think this is one of the questions that has not been learned and remains unanswered in Ukraine. So it was relatively easy during the revolution for people to get together because it was a clear kind of a goal. So we don't want towards the custom union. We want to go towards the European values. We don't want this administration to remain in place. We want it to go. But once these goals are kind of met, then it's not that easy because people have different views about how to change the country. And many people just didn't have any view at all, so that they were ready to stop here. So they consider this as their task is completed, their mission is over. And there is still very little discussion in Ukraine about the caveats of the political system. So we discuss it here. I think Mustafa knows it, Vlad knows it, but there's a very few people who really understand, and even they, I think, still need to develop a clear strategy or a plan how to deal with this system once they have a chance. So this is something that probably other countries may learn from Ukraine. So it's always good to have a plan, even during the dark era, actually. It's important to get prepared. It's important to find the like-minded people, to sit together, to think what... Once you have this chance, maybe 1 in 100, to get to power, what you do first and what you do next? Because we were in a situation when nobody was ready.
May I put one more metaphor, if possible? You know, we were discussing again today during the lecture is that for me the state is like Hobbes' Leviathan. You know, when it wants to take everything, it wants to be the father and power of everything. And in Ukraine, it's really you see it, how the state, through the system of the state, wants to get more and more in day-to-day life of people, in any new activities. And apparently, it should be vice versa, because the state should go less and less in day-to-day activities. And this paradox, is one of the biggest, the problems of today in Ukraine.
We were now joined by Anne, Anne Applebaum, and I'm going to ask you to comment on everything that was said. no, but we are very excited to have Anne join us in a more permanent sense. So Anne has just joined the LSE and she's building up a program on something that we just saw an example of. You missed. We had a professional disruptor here who tends to show up in these meetings and he. Would not give up to the floor. One thing that Anne is working on is exactly, you know, where does these phenomena come from, but also, of course, thinking about this in sort of given what's happening in debates in other parts of the world, we see the same type of disruptions or interventions, and this is what you're going to work on. Maybe you, in commenting,
I'm hoping not to work on protesters at events. No. Individual.
No, but it was a Anyhow, it's a.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, but you come here as someone who has worked a lot on transformations throughout the former Soviet space, and you have seen what happened in Ukraine in the Orange Revolution and the Maidan Revolution. Maybe you can give us a few.
Right. Well, first of all, I'm terribly sorry. I blame Google Calendar, which told me that this was starting at 6, and I was very happily leaving the house at 5 when I got a telephone call. And I am particularly sorry because actually the members of this panel are all people who I either know or have heard of and admire, and I would have liked to have heard what they said, and I'm hoping they'll tell me afterwards, and they're all much more informed about Ukraine than me. As I walked in, though, it's interesting that you were just getting to this theme about the need for a plan or a narrative. I was actually in Munich yesterday, the day before, at the Munich Security Conference, where actually the narrative was very disrupted by the U.S. election. But I had a long conversation with your colleague, Svetlana Zalishtra, who was there, who's a Ukrainian member of parliament, some of you probably know. And we had exactly this conversation. And the conversation was to do with her feeling of a missing narrative. It wasn't just so much that policies were missing, because she said to me, you know, there are good things happening. There are also lots of bad things happening, which we talked about. And I won't sort of repeat everything she said, because you may have just said it already. So, and I'm at a huge disadvantage in not wanting to repeat anybody. But it was more to do with finding a way to, you know, a language and a program that unifies people and sort of brings them to the next stage. And it's an interesting, it's a kind of meta conversation. I mean, of course, you can be very specific about reforms and programs and anti-corruption and so on. But it is also true, it's something I've thought about a lot recently as I've tried to understand a country that I have a lot of involvement in, which is Poland. I lived there in the 1990s, and I watched their transition out of communism. And I'm also watching them take another strange path right now. And I've thought a lot about the way in which, you know, having a unifying national narrative, you know, we're going in one direction, you know, how it makes all kinds of other things possible, and what does it come from, and how do you create it? And one of the things that you did have in Poland, actually, before 1989 and the 1980s, Eric probably knows this perfectly well, is you, before communism fell, you did have an extensive national conversation going on about what would we do if communism fell. And it was mostly sort of weird economists. I mean, it was people who, sorry, Eric, that your friend, sort of people nobody took all that seriously, Leszek Balcerowicz, you know, Jacek Rostowski, you know, kind of odd, sort of not very, none of them were particularly famous, particularly in Poland. You know, they were at that time all very young, and they were starting to think about how you would deconstruct a communist economy. And this was partly made possible because, as you remember, the 80s were a time when it was becoming clear that a lot of stuff wasn't working. And maybe there needed to be an alternative. But one thing that did happen was that when communism did fall, which in retrospect was mostly, of course, a geopolitical change rather than anything the Poles did. You know, they had their revolution was in 1981 and it was crushed. And in 1989, the thing was handed to them in some ways. But you did have a group of people in society who were very, very clear about what they wanted to do, where they wanted to go. You know, the narrative story was made much easier for them by the EU and NATO. You know, we want to join these institutions. We need to pass this set of laws in order to join them. And we have these guys, you know, who everybody thought was weird, who were weird 2 years ago, but they're ready to do it. And having some kind of political class that was ready to go made an enormous difference. It didn't last forever as a piece of magic, you know. As a thing that drove people together, because you gradually began to have, over the years, a split whereby some people believed that was working and had worked, and then there was another group, mostly, I think, for kind of political reasons and reasons of power, began creating an alternative vision, you know, that Poland needed to be more nationalistic and it needed to be more Catholic and it needed to reject things about modernity and so on, and that's now the dominant language of the government. Yes, you know Ukraine has always missed this cohesive sense, and it's partly because you didn't have the geopolitical luck of the Poles. You know that there was, there was the moment when the EU was open and NATO was open and these things could be joined. And partly for other reasons. I think, generally speaking, leaving the Soviet Union was much harder than leaving the Warsaw Pact. I mean, it's a much, particularly after 70 years rather than 40 years, you know, the cultural changes and the legacy of repression and, all kinds of things that are, some specific to Ukraine and some not, made it different. But, one of the things that the Maidan, this is what I said to Svetlana, one of the things that the Maidan could do, and sort of does, I think, is it could become, and this is really a question from me rather than a statement, because you know the answer better than me, is the Maidan could become a kind of founding narrative, you know, and I don't mean to say a mythology, and I don't mean to say that it's anything fake, but, you know, that it could be a, you know, here's what we achieved, here's why we achieved it, here are the lessons we can draw, and then you can begin to, even people who weren't part of it, if you can begin to draw them into it as a narrative. And I said, another thing I talked to her about, she was saying, well, what can you, you know, how, you, she always, a lot of Ukrainians don't like the idea that Ukraine always appears, this was in Munich, at the Munich Security Conference, they don't like Ukraine always seems to appear as a kind of beggar, please help us. What can we offer that's positive? And I said, why don't you offer the Maidan? You know, look, you here in the West are now being undermined by nationalism and populism and illiberal democracy. Here's what we did in Ukraine to fight it. You could maybe bring some of the lessons back and have that be something that Ukrainians could show the West. And I know that sounds absurd until you think about it for 5 minutes and you realize that there could be something to it. So, it seems to me that there needs to be some kind of conversation about how to... It's not just the people who were there on the square, but what were the motivating ideas behind it, and how can we include more people in it, and how do we make it the sort of that, rather than the desire to join the West, which I think right now will backfire because you're not going to be in EU or NATO anytime soon because of what's going on in the EU and NATO. And anyway, you might not want to be, actually, by the end of this year. But having that be a driving... some kind of driving narrative and finding ways to include people or teach, figuring out what the values of the Maidan are and spreading them. I don't know, but this is a question really for you all rather than me.
Yeah, but this is very much why Anne is here also, because we are working on putting up together a transformation lab, which is really about taking this narrative, looking at how different aspects of reform fit together, explaining to people how... what they do in one part in the central bank may be related to what's happening inside the judiciary, what's happening at different levels of government and so on. So I think this is very much on
But is that, I mean, am I nuts, or is that a fantasy, or what do you think?
Well, Vlad, I really want the audience to have a chance to come in again. You're part of the audience now, yes. Now, Vlad, just, you know, we were together in Tunisia. So Tunisia had a revolution much earlier. Some of the aspects, I remember, came to a new politician or a new policymaker or to the political parties, they said, you know, Tunisia is so different from Ukraine. And then every time you could say, actually, name, you know, that aspect of Tunisia that is different. And every time you could say, this is exactly like Ukraine. Of course, I think we both realized that this was two very different countries, but somehow there were a lot of lessons that could be learned. If you say a few words about that, then I really want to let in the audience also.
Look, I gave a lecture there to the students, and I put some statements and said, I asked about which country is it. They say about Tunisia. I said, no, it's about Ukraine, because you had a revolution, you had the president who left the country, you had economic problems, you had already changed three governments after the revolution, and they already changed five governments, I think. And when I came back to Kyiv, I just said, guys, I can easily relocate you to Tunisia and Tunisian ministers here, nothing will change.
Better weather.
I mean, more or less the same, because there were 300 ministers in Tunisia in the last 5 years. So I think whoever was already wanted to become a minister already became a minister. So now they just find who is more suitable to become a minister. And in Ukraine, this was a difference, because in Ukraine we didn't find yet the best ones probably in any of the ministries. So, you know, again, I think, and I was telling today during the lecture, average tenure of the one minister in Ukraine is from 11 to 13 months. This is like in Italy, like in Tunisia, in many countries. With 11, 15 months, you cannot build the institutions. You can do a lot of the firefighting. You can do a lot of the, you know, the political jokes. You can do a lot of the PR and give a lot of the interviews, for sure. And speaking about 10-year strategy, about your vision. But in 11 months, you will be asked to go out. You know, now is April. You know, our third government started last April. So I went recently to the government, and people say we don't do anything. We don't want to do very radical steps because 1 year will be in a few months, and who knows what will go, if we'll have this kind of confidence vote in the parliament or not. So the narrative is very simple. You need to believe in the country. You need to believe in the country, and you don't need to be afraid of the next elections. And this is what happened in Tunisia as well. You cannot be accurate, sorry, in that. You change the country. It's not the change, you know, you don't repair the apartment. You really need to change the country. You do for generations. If you strongly believe in that, you do that. If you have a vision, you do that. Don't be afraid of the next elections. For sure, if you are capable as a leader, you can combine around yourself the best team who would do that. If you're not the capable as a leader, you would take the not so strong people around you. You know, any of you would say, yes, for sure, it would be nice to have the smart people around. But say, would you like to have the smarter people around and reporting to you? You know, the answer is not always yes. You know, I worked many years in the corporate, so you know that you try to find the people who are not so smart as you, just not to look, or even much lower smarter than you, just to look better, you know, nearby. So these were all these lessons around. Weak organizations is everywhere. You know, I used today the example, and Eric was a little bit even arguing with me. There is a nice book of Louis Gerstner, who said that the elephants cannot dance. This is about the reforms of IBM in the 90s. You know, and IBM is a huge organization, it's a global organization, and they experienced a lot of the changes. And they had the guy who came from American Express to change the IBM. And when I was reading it, it was about National Bank in 2015. Everything was about that. One of the words was criminology, for example. Criminology, you know what criminology is?
They don't know, I think.
Criminology is, as Louis Gerstner explaining, is when the foreigners were looking on 1st of May or 7th of November demonstrations on Red Square in Soviet Union, they were looking on Mavzolei, who was the main place where people were staying, and they were looking who is nearby the leaders. Is the second, the third, or fourth? And they changed the dynamics. If you become further from the main leader or you become closer to the main leader. So I came to the, and he said, when I came to IBM, I came to the room and there was a, you know, every time they were changing the plates, who was closer to the boss or who, I came to the central bank and I said, can we change the plates? He said, no. Why? Because you are the right hand and you are the left hand and you should be here. And they said, no, let's sit in another place. No, you cannot do that. And we try to change it. So the issue is very simple. You can make changes in the country. You need to strongly believe in that. The narrative, we recently organized a meeting on two weekends before. We spent 2 days with Mustafa and 50 other people discussing what to do. And it is not a political move. It's just people who were gathering, you know, who were in the government and understanding, you know, what the lessons learned and not learned. And you know what? On the content, what to be done, there was zero difference, mm-hmm. zero gap. So whatever was said...
You mean in terms of policy?
Yeah, policy. Yeah. We organized like open space concept. There was 20 different main important topics. We gathered in the different groups. And later we came. So nobody said, no, we want to have stronger state and involvement of the state more in the life. No, everybody wants to have a liberal state. We don't want to privatization. Moreover, we want to do reprivatization. No, everybody wants the privatization. Land, rent reform should be done. Pension reform should be done. Banking sector reform should be done. Public sector should be, you know, smaller and more paid. You know, I mean, there is a concept. People will go and work.
Then you have to sell it, though.
We had one group. Well, it was interesting because we had two different groups. One was said 10 most critical reforms to be done, and the second group was 10 most popular reforms to be done.
No, but you can
zero.
You can do the critical reform. This was the sort of lesson of Eastern Europe. You can do the critical, the difficult reforms if they're in a context. You know, you have to somehow be able to explain to people, look, here's why we want a smaller state. You know, it's because, you know, we have this legacy of totalitarianism and we want to take it apart.
And it's easy, but you will not be elected. Yeah.
Okay, now I really have to let the audience. We have a question there in the middle. And two more. So, yeah.
Mrs. Thatcher sold it to people. You can sell it to people.
Yeah.
Oh, microphone. Thank you very much. I'm Eric Shuli from King's College London. Just one comment about your speech. You said 11 months, but still 11 months government is better than 17 years, like Putin is doing. So it's much better. And I would like to come into this debate about marketing the Maidan, as you've mentioned.
I didn't say marketing, but yeah.
But what? Because I can speak from the experience of Georgia. That's why I want to make a point. The thing is, when the new government tries to position their achievement as an asset or as a symbol, if you like, of power, that is the success of revolution or this Maidan or the Rose Revolution in Georgia, I think then many things are not done properly and they try to adjust themselves to populism. Like in the country like United States, like Trump is doing this, I find a lot of things similar and the United States can check it, but places like Ukraine and Georgia will struggle with checking and kind of doing this. And I would like to hear your comments.
Great.
Thank you.
So one question over here.
Hi. I'll try to be brief. My name is Bohdan Tsup, and I'm a Ukrainian journalist based here in London. My question is about the elephant in the room, the one that was just taken out.
Yeah.
I mean Russia, because Russia is a great counter-revolutionary force. And the history of Russia shows that it did a lot to suppress lots of revolutions in Europe, talking about Prague Spring Revolution, Hungary. We can go deep in history. But you didn't mention that. Does it mean that Russia is not strong enough to choke Ukrainian revolution yet?
Okay. I think this, for sure we will have reactions to this. So, yeah, I had one more there behind you. Here. You will get later.
thank you very much. My question is about the role of the IMF, because we've talked about so much about structural reforms and how to actually make policy happen, and I would be very interested in your views, seeing from the inside, how IMF was really helpful, because I've heard still in London several such talks, and there were people from inside that said that, yeah, it was good that you can point fingers at IMF of pushing through reforms, but at the same time, they are just coming from outside and they don't really understand the country. I would be very happy to hear some comments.
Okay. So I have one more question.
Vesna Popovsky sees UCL. Research which we've done here at European Institute at LSE pointed out that Ukraine is a very polarized and fragmented country. My question is about another elephant in the room, and that is Ukrainian population. All research points out how Ukrainian population is completely disjointed with the political sphere, with the political parties, with the politicians, but not only with them, also with the civil society, and sees elements of the political elite and civil society. It's a very suspicious about them. You were saying that there are strategies and you are developing them and policies, how actually to get, or to put it in a vulgar terms, to sell your message to the Ukrainian population. Can we hear a little bit more about it? Because I think that that is vital for the for the Maidan revolution to continue. Thank you.
Okay.
From the first question, so about is it better 11 months or 17 years? I remember the day when I wrote on Facebook, what today we say thank you and goodbye to four people who spent totally in total 107 years in the central bank. And we put out as our internal, not mission, but at least the target is we want to become the magnet for best talents in the central bank, to attract them there and not to allow them to retire there in the central bank. Mm-hmm. Because we wanted them to work 5-7 years and later to go back to the public, to the private sector. But in this respect, the people should be valued there, because so far people from the central bank was very difficult to find a job in the commercial sector, because they were neither doing people statistics or analytics, etc. They were not required. Now it's already changed, and Elena can tell you better about that. I think about Russia, you know, Mustafa maybe can tell more. I would just repeat what I said before. The Russia is for sure one of the biggest elephants, but only one of them, you know, because we have still the fight with our past, or which is a past of the Soviet Union, which is very deeply in the DNA of institutions, very deeply in DNA of many people in the country. You know, even the new people, you know, they are very paternalistic in their mindset. They think that, you know, the majority think the state should take care about many things. And when state is cannot or not capable to take care of many things, starting, you know, from maybe from kindergarten to school to universities to hospitals, for sure, they're very much disappointed. And here I would come. So this is, and corruption is the second big elephant. You know, there is a joke in Ukraine that many people in Ukraine are voting for two main things. One is against of corruption, and another one is to have a friend who could help in case something were happening. Okay? So this is the second thing. And the third, about the connection to people. I would slightly disagree with you on the concept of connection of the people to the politics in Ukraine. Because, you know, in the past we were telling that people in Soviet Union or in Ukraine, they definitely understand very well two things. One is how to resolve detectives, and the second was football, you know, soccer, so because everybody knew how to better score in the games versus Liverpool or Manchester United for Dynamo Kiev. So the third topic which came in the last 10 years is politics. And this is, I think, one of the biggest threats we have, because in Ukraine, unfortunately, the horizon of people, they have only two horizons. One is the family, and family is a saint inside of Ukraine. It's a very important, it's not about survival mechanism. You have the circle of trust, and this trust is only inside of your family. You know, this doesn't go beyond. So it's not your Western values when you trust by fact you trust other people. You should gain the trust someone, but it will be very hard to do because the trust is going only inside of the family. And the second level is already becoming immediately the state. So you are immediately working on the. You understand how to do politics, what to do with NATO, what to do with European Union. You forget about your yard, you know, about your building. Your apartment will be nice, but also in the corridors there will be no light, because if you think that the state should put the light in your room, you will not clean your yard outside of the building, because you think the state should do that. You don't go with municipalities. You don't really believe in even municipal elections, because you don't care about municipal elections. For sure, for you is much more important is the president and the parliament. This is the people where you work. People don't participate in NGOs how to implement. And immediately goes there. So I think what we need to build in Ukraine in the next years is really to feel this to build this feeling of accountability for many steps, which is a gap between your family and the state as such.
Okay, Olena, do you want to?
Yeah, there's so many. Let me take a more economic issue. This question on the role of the IMF. Yeah, that I think that's played a very important role in Ukraine, and for some organizations or branches of power, like the central bank, that was a chance to promote their vision. So actually they drafted the part of the memorandum, they drafted the strategy of the banking system, so it became a Ukraine's commitment. But for the most of the reforms, actually, the IMF was an important anchor, and this including the creation of anti-corruption institution. So the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, which was created in Ukraine under the supervision of the IMF and the EU, is one of the most not yet successful institutions, but one of the most promising institutions. So it potentially can be as powerful as Romanian Anti-Corruption Bureau. So, and I think that IMF is learning on Ukraine's case as well, because they changed the scope of the program. It's the first time when anti-corruption gets a very high focus and the broad context in the IMF program. So it's first time was done with Ukraine. So Ukraine is kind of a litmus test for the IMF, whether this broader scope of their expertise will be successful, and I hope it will be successful, because well, now we see that this new institution now are working. So I think that's still a very important role, and sometimes the IMF might be wrong in some issues, but in general for a country such as Ukraine, that would be important to stay in the program.
Mustafa, you have been...
Okay, I will try to short answer, because my colleagues told everything. You know, it's, when you're talking about IMF, I will try to combine these two questions about this connection about IMF and about Russian also. You know, that thing that the two currencies we doesn't have now in Ukraine, two most important institutions, is just political will and trust of people. People don't trust each other, and we doesn't have political will. What is IMF? It is a little bit ridiculous that IMF dictates in Ukraine anti-corruption policy. Don't you find? I mean, just... But this is... Why? And I know that it's not only about anti-corruption. In many other issues and topics, IMF is dictating. Not because IMF is so smart, because they see that we doesn't have inner will of politicians to do that. And I'm glad that the IMF is our partners. When I say I mean civil society, yes? So, and it's not only about IMF. It's about United States, about EU, it's about all institutions who are financing. So unfortunately, having our own political will of our leadership, someone else is paying our politician to be more persistent in reforms. And it's a little bit humiliating me as a politician, as a parliamentarian. But okay, this is our time and we should follow this agenda. And but the consequence of this thing is trust. If you see that your president or right prime minister, they're really the best we had in our history last 25 years. I mean, they're really the best. And prime minister and president. But unfortunately, we don't want to compare them with those people who was before them. We want to
compared Mr. Poroshenko with not with Yanukovych, but the Poroshenko we expected him to be, and with Groysman also. So when people they see the lack of will of this politician, they see the vested interests, they don't trust them. And unfortunately, we as a young politicians and all political class, we are victims of this strategy of those people who are leaders in running country. Because 25 years people hated politicians. And now, suddenly, came some people, young people without money, without history. I mean, we have some track record, but no one knows what we did in our previous life, saying that, look, we are better. Come on. I mean, we saw many young people before you who lost or who sold country. And so it is, and we should be naive thinking that someone will trust us immediately. To build up this trust, I think this is one of the goal of our generation. Maybe next generation will be much more successful, much more happy with that. And and this is about Russia. And in that sense, I can say that Russia really plays very bad role in historical in our history, in our reforms. But I can say one thing. Maybe it's a little cynical, but I think that Russia plays also a good role. Because mobilizing people, uniting people against one goal, and when you say polarized, yes, people are polarized, but not about war. Everyone is united. We have some pro-Russian, but we are not talking about them. Yes, it's not too much in our country. But in Russian invasion, Russian attacks, Russian aggression, I think this is one of the reasons why civil society and activists in Ukraine, they are not so aggressively going outside and repeating revolution. What we had in Egypt, for example. Yeah, in Egypt. We will not have that. And that is the consequence of consciousness of our civil society. And one of the reasons is Russia. But Russia really can change it. I mean, Russia can influence in different way. In my perspective, from my point of view, I think that that Russian now they will try to divide people inside, mm-hmm. And that is biggest challenge now. Because look what we have: Ljashko. I mean, okay, we have different parties. I mean, just maybe now everyone knows Ljashko, it's bad. I mean, it's so, but we have different parties who came from Maidan, different forces who came from Maidan, but they have very different point of view on even on liberal reforms. Those 50 people who met just 2 weeks ago in Kyiv, yes, we are united. But if you ask Ljashko, who has 20% support of people, he's against of land reform. This guy, I mean, he's dividing country on that issues. Look at Tymoshenko, about housekeeping, about tariffs, about salaries. So I think it's Russia, but it's not only Russia. It's also Ukrainian things. So what they can do, Russians, I think, and unfortunately, I cannot. Doesn't have proof of that, but I think the same strategy they had in Europe, financing right radicals. The same thing they can do in Ukraine, unfortunately. It doesn't mean that they're paying directly. No. It's much more complicated. Even, trying to force these radical wings to show, to expose themselves. First of all, it's totally ruining image of Ukraine. Yes? Because in our country now, right radical wings doesn't have big influence yet. I hope will not. Not because I am myself is Mustafa, but because I understand what the consequence will be closed. We will close country. So the right wings and radical wings is the influence of Russia in Europe, in Ukraine also. Thank you.
I should disagree with one topic. I should agree with one topic of Mustafa, because Mustafa said about the lack of trust, and I agree with that. And the second, he said political will, and I hate this word. I hate this word because it is not about the political will, it's about leadership and about institutions. I would say the second big factor for Ukraine is the weak institutions or lack of institutions who could struggle, because if it would stay about the political will, I tell you, we would never be successful in the National Bank of our reforms. We closed 85 banks in the last 2 years and a half. behind any of them was some oligarch or bad guys or the corrupted guys. We even nationalized the biggest bank of the country, which had 30% market share on the market, which was supported by the one of the biggest or the second richest person in the country. You know, and we managed to do that. We managed to do the internal transformation not because of political will, because the political will was against us. We did it because we built the institution and we had a strong leadership inside. And if you don't have the institutions, if your institution is not capable to tackle the problems, you will not succeed, even if you would have the political will.
Thank you. On that note, I think we have reached the end of our time. We got a little bit of drama. We got a sense of the, you know, this is...
Can I say something about Philip?
You want to say something about Philip?
Yeah. Well,
okay, very briefly. And
you know, I want to say about this, our colleague, because he's media and journalist, he was my previous colleague. You know, one thing I think it is very important for you to understand about our country, which is the problem of all Europe, United States, is media and propaganda. It is true. But unfortunately, society and people and media in Europe doesn't understand the real problem they have. Because thinking that Russian troops is killing people, but Russian media is protecting media and protecting freedom of speech is something very, you know, naive. Because Russian state media is the same state agencies like Minister of Defense, like Minister of Economy, and it's very naive to think that they will protect freedom of speech or election or some values of European Union. Okay. So regarding that, I would say that headquarters of Russia today in New York, there is no difference between this headquarter and tank in Donbass. It's the same. They have the same strategy. And I think if you would not understand, we'll be clear with that, we'll have big problem in Europe, in United States also. Okay. And my colleague, Philip, is one part of this tank, very effective. But I'm happy that you made your decision about him.
And, so we will indeed finish now, but I just think what I take away from this is that the work is not done. You know, it's now that it's actually happening. There were all these ideas and policies and so on, but they now have to be implemented. And all those things that you've fought for, it's not assured that this will actually fundamentally change Ukraine in the long term. So it's now that these kind of debates, these kind of reflections on what has been achieved is so important. So thank you very much for coming here and giving us...